You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. If you're listening for the first time, this is a preview station for Kick-Ass Politics, where I put up a few sample episodes for you to check out. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like it, then I encourage you to go to our main program at Kick-Ass Politics and subscribe to the show. There are a lot more episodes there. Just search for Kick-Ass Politics on iTunes, or if you go to the information page for this episode on iTunes, there's a link right there to subscribe to the main show. Also, feel free to check out our webpage at kickasspolitics.com, where you'll find show notes, book recommendations, and all kinds of extras. I'm Ben Mathis, and I hope you enjoy this preview of Kick-Ass Politics. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. And right now, Audible.com has a special promotion for listeners of Kick-Ass Politics. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial by going to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics or click on the sponsor link on our webpage at kickasspolitics.com. In September 2012, a single mom from New York drove down to Florida to look at condos with her teen son and her baby grandchild. It had been a nice little family trip. Then, while heading north back to New York on I-95, she was pulled over by Georgia State Troopers. And that's when a routine traffic stop turned into Alda Gentile's worst nightmare.
We were driving home from Florida. We were looking at houses or condos we were thinking about, like, renting or buying, maybe. And all of a sudden, I saw lights, and I told my son, I think we're getting pulled over. He came to the window, and I asked him, why did you pull us over? And he said, because you were speeding. And I said, really? So I said, well, it's, you know, I'm not going to be disrespectful to the police, so if you think we're speeding, I guess give us a ticket. And he said, no, it's not that easy. And he said to my son, you have to get out of the car. And I'm like, what? Well, can you please tell me what's going on? This is not a usual stop. He goes, oh, it's not usual because we know you're running drugs. I'm like, whoa, I don't know what you're talking about. I have a baby back here. That is my son, and you got the wrong people.
What she didn't realize was that the cops weren't really interested in drugs. They were looking for cold, hard cash. And Alda Gentile was about to get a crash course in a predatory law enforcement tool that's been compared to legalized theft.
So he's like, well, we know you have money in the car. You have money in the car, don't you? And I said, actually, I do. I have money in my suitcase, in my trunk. What does that have to do with anything? He says, where were you? And I told him where we were. And I actually had a list of houses that we looked at. And this is why we were here. I was looking at all these houses. So he said, how much money is in your suitcase? And I was like, I don't even feel like I have to tell you that. That's my money, my suitcase. He goes, get out of the car. And he yelled at another cop, get their cell phones. And they took our cell phones away from us. And he took me out of the car, took the baby out of the car. It was 100 degrees out. And I was like, can you please explain to me what is going on? He says, well, what's going on? We're taking y'all money. I go, what? What are you talking about? You can't just take people's money. And one guy did put his hand on his phone and said, get in the bushes and don't tell me we can't take your money. We're going to take your money and you're going to get on your knees and say, please, please. And I'll think about it. But then guess what? I'm still taking your money.
Alda Gentile asked the troopers how they could take her money when she hadn't done anything wrong. They told her that the fact that she had a few thousand in cash was suspicious, and they had legal grounds to seize her money for not keeping it in a bank. Alda Gentile was in disbelief.
I asked him, how can you just take my money when you didn't do anything wrong? Because you carrying money is suspicious. That's what they told me. I said, how is me carrying money suspicious? I told you why. My girlfriend works enough. They told me to bring cash in case we saw something we liked. And they said, you have to have money in the bank. I said, that's not in law that I can't have cash. They have no right to do that. They were searching the car, and they found the money in my trunk, and they were counting it up, and they were making jokes. And that's when I realized they know we're not drug dealers. This is all just to rob us. To me, they were pirates with badges. That's all they were. They held us there from 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I think we got out of there around 12 o'clock at night. They gave me back my cell phone. I told them that baby was starving. You're taking all my money, everything I have. I said, I don't have any money left in my wallet. How do you expect me to get back to New York? You're going to leave us stranded like this for the baby at midnight? So he said, well, that's not our problem. We don't care about your tears here, girl. I made a joke about my cousin Vinny, the movie. So the last thing I remember saying to them when I left, I said, you guys, you think you're keeping my money, but you're not. And you can make all the jokes you want about Italians in Brooklyn or a cousin Vinny. I said, I hope, did you see the end of that movie? Because Vinny won.
The Georgia state troopers had no idea who they were messing with. Instead of just giving up and continuing back to New York, Alda Gentile stayed in the area, and she began raising hell.
I went to my sister's, and I spent the next 3 days there calling everybody I could possibly think to call. I did call the White House. I called the governor. I called the Sheriff's Association. I called everyone. I spent 3 days calling people. They sent my buddy back within 5 days, and I think that's because of the governor. He said to me, they all took your money and threw you and kept you like that for no reason with a baby in the car. Those boys went too far. He called the major of the state troopers. The major said, I'm sending your money back right away. Call it the rage of an Italian single mother. There was no way doing that to me and getting away with it. There was no way.
Alda Gentile was the victim of civil asset forfeiture. Thanks to her tenacity, things worked out in her case. But for many other innocent Americans, a little-known but frequently abused law has turned their lives upside down and cost them everything they have. Stay tuned, because today we're exploring the living hell of civil asset forfeiture. And folks, I can promise you, you're going to get pissed.
Hollywood to Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
Civil asset forfeiture is a controversial legal process that gives law enforcement the authority to seize any money or private property suspected of involvement in a crime. That's right. Even if you haven't committed a crime, if the police suspect that your car, your boat, or even your home might have somehow been involved in a crime, then they can justify taking it. By far, the vast majority of civil asset forfeiture victims are never charged with, much less convicted of, a crime. In fact, most aren't even suspected of committing a crime. But as Alda Gentile found out, probable cause for seizing a person's money or property is as easy as saying, "That's an awful lot of cash there, ma'am. I guess you must be laundering money." Now, why would the police want to pick on innocent Americans? Well, under this controversial law, local, state, and federal authorities get to keep seized cash and assets, turning a badge into a license to print money, and law enforcement agencies into money-making enterprises. In fact, civil asset forfeiture has become legalized extortion on an industrial scale, raking in a whopping $12 billion in cash and property every year. And what do the police do with all that loot? Well, they can pretty much spend it on whatever they want. Police salaries, pensions, overtime pay, new equipment, vehicles, alcohol, and even parties and vacations. Here's how Ken Burton, the police chief of Columbia, Missouri, explained it to a Citizens Police Review Board.
You know, we come across forfeiture funds sometimes.
How do you decide forfeiture funds?
You know, it's usually based on a need. Well, I'll take that back.
Discretion, though, I'd imagine you sign off on.
Yeah, there's some limitations on it. You know, it's actually there's not really on the forfeiture stuff. We just usually base it on something that would be nice to have. It's kind of like pennies from heaven, you know, it gets you a toy or something that you need, is the way we typically look at it.
Every time it rains, it rains.
Well, let's just take a look at some of the toys that police departments have seized for their own use. Aside from cars, boats, cell phones, computers, and jewelry, police have helped themselves to a Zamboni, a margarita machine, and 650 gold-plated police whistles. One department even seized a tanning bed for the use of the police chief's wife. And get this, if you want to get your own property back from the police, you'd better be prepared to hire a lawyer, wait up to years for a hearing, and then try to prove your own innocence. Just ask Russ Caswell, owner of the Caswell Motel in Tewksbury, Massachusetts.
Yeah, I own a small motel, and it's been in a family my father built it in 1955, and I took it over in 1984 and have run it ever since. And we never had any trouble with the police. We always cooperated with them and did whatever they might ask us to and so on. And so one day I go to get the mail, and there's these forfeiture notices in there, one for me, one for my wife. And they had a lot of legal stuff in there. But basically what it said was, we're taking your property. And they listed these 8 drug cases that had, mostly small stuff, kids with marijuana. A couple of them didn't even involve drugs. And I never heard of most of them because the police are always so secretive about things. I never even knew most of them existed.
Oh, and by the way, the 8 arrests that the authorities cited in this case were over the course of 18 years. Over those same 18 years, Russ Caswell rented out over 200,000 hotel rooms. That means the police were trying to take away his motel because of incidents that involved 0.00004% of his guests.
They never accused me of anything or anybody that works at the motel of anything. And I have no criminal record at all. I've never been questioned about anything by anybody. And I was just kind of dumbfounded by the whole thing. I figured it'd be some kind of mistake that they thought I did something that, you know, just misinterpreting something. So I got my lawyer, and I told him the story, and he was kind of baffled by it. And so we deposed like 8 of the police who were involved in these different cases, and none of them had anything to say against me at all. They all said the same thing, how we cooperate with them and all of this kind of stuff. Until we get to this DEA agent, Vincent Kelly, and I guess I didn't mention it before, but the motel was appraised for $1.5 million with no mortgage. So we get to this DEA agent, Vincent Kelly, and my lawyers asked him, how do you pick properties to go after? Like, as well, I look on the internet and in the newspapers and stuff and try to find places that have had some sort of drug arrest on them. And then I go to the local police and go to the Registry of Deeds and to see how much equity the people have in the property. My lawyer says, what's the equity position got to do with anything? And he says, if you can believe this, and this is coming right from the DEA agent, he says, we won't go after a property unless the owner has at least $50,000 worth of equity in it. So that right there told me exactly what this was about. It was about stealing people's property. It was nothing to do with drugs.
Ironically, the Home Depot and the Motel 6 next door to Caswell's had far worse histories of drug activity. But the authorities knew better than to mess with large corporations with deep pockets and teams of in-house lawyers. So they picked on Russ Caswell instead.
I'm thinking, you know, they're going to come up with something that I don't know about. They did something they thought I did, or somebody that works for me did, or something. And we had, I think it was like 8 or 10 of the police there. They were down there on the government side testifying for the government, but what they were saying, you'd swear they were my witnesses. Because they had nothing bad to say about me or anybody else. They'd say how we cooperate. And even Tom Casey, who was one of the ones that signed the complaint against us, he even testified. See, I go down to the motel and talk to people. They're very cordial. And I have complete access to the office, and if I want to look at anything, you know, look at their videos, their cameras, and so on, and go through the cards, and say, yeah, they cooperate all everything with us. One of their spokesmen there in a newspaper article, she even said, she said, oh, we have nothing against Mr. Caswell. It's his property. Like my property was running around stealing people's cars or something. You know, it was just bizarre. The judge could even see, you could see in her facial expressions, a couple of things that they said, she just kind of rolled her eyes, you know, like, what are you people doing? The way they win these things, which I found out, it's not that you've done something wrong. It's that you can't afford to fight it. Well, the Institute for Justice was my lawyers, but I had to spend $100,000 of my own money before they come along.
Thankfully, the Institute for Justice did come along, and they took Russ Caswell's case for free. The Institute for Justice describes themselves as a nonprofit public interest law firm dedicated to protecting individual liberty. And they've defended a number of civil asset forfeiture victims pro bono. Here's Rob Johnson, an attorney for the Institute.
One of the things that is unique about civil forfeiture is that property owners actually are required to prove their own innocence in order to get their property back after the government has initiated forfeiture proceedings. For Russ, we had to actually prove that Russ was unaware of what was going on in his motel, and he actually had the burden to prove that to the court in order to keep his property interest in his motel.
With the help of the lawyers from the Institute for Justice, Russ Caswell prevailed, but the case took a heavy toll on Russ, his ailing wife, and eventually on taxpayers as well. Here's how Russ tells it.
So anyway, we won the case, and the government had to pay me back and pay them back, which came to a total, I think their cost was around $500,000 with mine. So this cost the government, just for us, plus what they had to spend to do this ridiculous crap. So I'm guessing this had to cost them well over $1.5 million to do this. Taxpayer dollars, and nothing happens to them. And they just do these things with no proof of anything. It's just that this happened on a property. It's all it takes for them to do this to people. It went on 3.5 years. You know, it tears your whole life apart, really. You don't know what's going on. And that's what they do. They don't care. I mean, they could go on for 10 years. They don't care. You know, they're probably making a job for themselves. I don't know what they're doing. You know, I've heard of confiscating people's property, but I thought it was people who were smuggling in a car or whatever, you know, some criminal activity. But this deal here, they're just stealing property from people and even saying they've done nothing. In fact, it's just hard to believe that can be happening in this country. It's something you'd expect under a dictator or some third world country or something. I don't know. It's just something that you'd never think would be happening in America, where they're just coming along and taking people's property and never even accusing them of anything.
After his long battle with the government, Russ Caswell had had enough, and he was ready to just retire. Last August, he sold the Caswell Motel for $2.5 million, and it was torn down to make way for an entertainment complex. Believe it or not, Russ was one of the lucky ones. Most victims just give up. In just a moment, I'll talk with Roger Pilon. He's the founder and director of the Cato Institute's Center for Constitutional Studies, and an adjunct professor of government at Georgetown University. He's also the publisher of Cato's Supreme Court Review, and he's testified before Congress on civil asset forfeiture. He says police have become addicted to forfeiture funds, and it leads to what he calls policing for profit. He'll run down the history of the law, how it got so out of control, and how some local cops are circumventing state laws and cutting sweetheart deals with the feds to get and keep your stuff. That in just a minute. This portion of the podcast is sponsored by Fiverr. That's F-I-V-E-R-R. Now, folks, you've heard me rave about Fiverr before. Fiverr is the world's largest online marketplace for services, with over 100,000 categories all offered for a fixed base price of just $5. Logo design, business consulting, marketing, business cards and stationery, web design, translation, transcription, proofreading, legal consulting, and just about any other service you can possibly imagine, all offered at a base price of just $5. In fact, you know the announcer who does our intro to Kick-Ass Politics? I found him on Fiverr, a professional radio announcer to do our intro for just $5. And right now, when you go to kickasspolitics.com and click on the Fiverr ad on our sponsor page, you'll be showing your support for the show, and you'll get some great offers on services tailored to your needs. Whatever you need done, find it on Fiverr. If you like Kick-Ass Politics and you want to keep us on the air, then please support the show by making a donation to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/KickAssPolitics. That's GoFundMe.com/KickAssPolitics. Or go to the show website and click on the donate link. Your support will help keep us producing new and even more interesting programs in the future. That's GoFundMe.com/KickAssPolitics. Enjoy the rest of the show. I'm joined today by Roger Pilon, who's the founder and director of the Center for Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute and an adjunct professor of government at Georgetown University. He's been on top of this issue of civil asset reform for at least two decades now. Roger has testified before the House Judiciary Committee on the issue, and he's written numerous articles calling for reform of civil asset forfeiture laws. Roger, thank you again for coming on the show to talk about this. I'm sure that you hear this a lot, but when I first learned of the civil asset forfeiture abuses going on in this country, I thought to myself, there's no way that this can be true. It has to be unconstitutional. But apparently it's legal, and law enforcement is getting away with it and victimizing innocent Americans every day. So walk us through this.
All right, Ben, I'd be glad to do so. You're not alone in so reacting, let me say. The first thing a lawyer says when a case comes before him of civil asset forfeiture for the first time is, this can't be right, but it is. And this is an area of our law, a backwater of the law, so to speak, with roots in the Middle Ages. And if I can just give you a quick history, it'll give you an idea of how it was that we got to this state of affairs. Well, this theory reached this country in the form of admiralty law back in the 18th century. And the idea was that if a ship owner in England sent goods to the colonies, and if the tariff was not paid, then at this end, the owner would be difficult to reach. So the goods on the ship would be seized until the tariff was paid, or if not, they would be then seized for the government. That's the way it came to be part of the narrow area of American law, namely admiralty law. But then it came into its own during Prohibition with all manner of prohibited contraband and with the money associated with that, the ill-gotten goods, so to speak. And of course, it came to life again later on during the war on drugs. But once it was seen by police departments and prosecutors across the country as a ready source of revenue, then it really came into its own. Because under most forfeiture statutes, the police departments get to keep the seized assets. So we have such atrocities as Volusia County, Florida police or sheriffs are stopping cars going south on I-95 and seizing from the drivers any funds that they may have in excess of $100 on the theory that this is money that is going to be used to buy drugs. Notice they don't stop cars going north on I-95 to seize the drugs. They're not really interested in the drugs. They're interested in the money because they get to keep it. And whole police departments have been furnished with money seized in just this way. And I can give you numerous other examples, not necessarily involving drugs, where you see the perverse incentives that are set up by this area of the law, such that police departments become addicted, so to speak, on forfeiture proceeds.
They're literally taking cash out of people's cars. And these people, in many cases, have committed no crime. When they seize the assets, they're not even charged with a crime.
That's
much
correct.
Less convicted.
What we have here is a theory whereby the goods themselves are guilty. Just to give you an example, again, this one involved drugs. The grandson here in D.C., next door, comes over to his grandmother's house, makes a call from the house to consummate a drug deal. The house is seized by the police for forfeiture to the government and then sold, of course, with the proceeds going to the police department because it is said to facilitate a crime. You have police in New York City doing DUI arrests and then seizing the car because the car is said to have facilitated that crime. In other words, the car, the house, the money, these are all said to be guilty, and never is a crime necessary to be proven because it's the property that is guilty.
That's what's so bizarre to me, and it's just crazy because I look at some of these individual cases, and the guilt is with the actual property, not the person. So all these cases come up with titles like the United States versus $5,400 in U.S. currency, or
that's
the
right.
United States versus a 99 Chevy Tahoe. I mean,
that's right. This is the or the United States versus a 123 Oak Street.
Right.
Now, the problem is this. Suppose the owner is completely innocent. Then the police will, or the prosecutor, will put to the owner the following proposition. Oh, you want to challenge this? Well, we can turn this into a criminal prosecution. Now the owner is going to think twice because oftentimes you find that the evidence is kind of shaky, but you never know how it's going to go before a jury. Secondly, it's extremely costly to defend yourself against the government, which has far more assets in most cases than the individual being charged. And you may have a loss of, say, $10,000, but if it costs you $50,000 to defend yourself, and you may end up being found guilty as well, you're going to just walk away from your loss, and it is, in other words, a kind of shakedown racket.
It does sound like legalized extortion. And the thing that's amazing to me is it's hard for me to wrap my head around the idea that we're innocent until we're proven guilty, and that supposedly there's a requirement of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. But that doesn't apply in this case because it's not criminal. Technically, it's civil, right?
That's right. Well, there are two parts of asset forfeiture that we need to distinguish. There is criminal asset forfeiture, and that usually is not problematic the way civil asset forfeiture is, because there the owner of the goods has to be is charged with a crime, and then the goods are forfeited subsequent to prosecution and conviction, as, for example, ill-gotten goods or the instruments of crime, and so on and so forth. But we're talking here not about criminal asset forfeiture, but about civil asset forfeiture. And here again, the thing that you got to recognize is how profitable this is for the police departments. The Department of Justice seizures alone went from $27 million in 1985 to $556 million in 1993 to nearly $4.2 billion in 2012. And since 2001, the federal government has seized $2.5 billion without either bringing a criminal action or issuing a warrant. So you see, the key to understanding this is, as I said a moment ago, the perverse incentives that this branch of our law has set in play. And just give you a couple more examples. There was the famous case in Detroit, Michigan, where the husband was working the night shift, and on his way home, he had a dalliance with the prostitute in his car. Well, he was found, and the car was seized, which was half-owned, or jointly owned, by the man's wife. And this case worked its way all the way to the Supreme Court, where she lost. And so not only was she done in by her husband, so to speak, but she was done in by the law. She lost her half interest in the car because it facilitated the crime. It was where the, quote, crime took place. And so they go after easy prey, low-hanging fruit. They don't go after Hertz rental car, where you have DUI operations, because Hertz will defend itself. They'll go after John Doe, who gets caught under DUI, and they'll seize his car.
Well, right. Yeah, they're going after these mom-and-pop operations, and the government just wants to help itself to other people's property, and they haven't committed a single crime.
The burden is upon the owner to prove his innocence, not the government to prove that, let's take in the case of the motel situation, that the owner did everything he could to prevent prostitution or drug deals taking place in his motel. In other words, the implication is you're deputizing private people to see to it that crime is not taking place. And if they are not assiduous enough in doing so, then the property is seized because the owner does not satisfy sufficiently the innocent owner defense. These are the kinds of cases that we see out there.
Well, it's just the abuse seems to be so rampant, and they see something that they want, your property, they can find a way to justify it. Just merely having cash on you, a large amount of cash, is guilt enough, apparently.
Oh, yes. Here's a case of, I think it was a Tennessee landscape man who worked in cash. And don't forget, we're talking about people who live close to the margin and don't have bank accounts, who deal in cash. And here was a landscape man who was on his way to New Orleans to buy plants and so forth for his business. And he was traveling with $10,000 in his pocket. He was stopped along the way, and they seized the money because what was he doing traveling with that much cash in his pocket? Or here's another one. A man has a flight service whereby he ferries people around in private planes. Well, he picks up a passenger, flies him to Las Vegas. Unbeknownst to him, this man is a drug dealer of some sort. He's met when he lands in Las Vegas by federal officials who arrest the passenger and then seize the plane because it facilitated the criminal activity. These examples just go on and on of this kind.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I'll ask you one last question. I'm just curious. I have to ask this. If you were in this situation and you got pulled over for a busted taillight or whatever, and a police officer asked you if you have any large amounts of cash on you, because they do that, what would you say? How would you handle that?
Do you have probable cause to arrest me? Am I free to go? Is what I would respond.
All right. Good advice. Well, Roger, thanks again for helping me make sense of this nightmarish law. Hopefully we'll get some movement in Congress on this and put an end to this abuse. Well, thank you again.
Now, if your listeners want more on this, they can go to the Cato Institute website. They can go to my bio, and they'll find articles on civil asset forfeiture. Or they can go to the Institute for Justice website. Basically, they've got to bring these complaints to the legislatures, federal and state.
Well, certainly people should get on board with this. I'll post a link to the Cato Institute and the Center for Constitutional Studies on the website so people can find out more about this. And yeah, definitely people need to get out there and start contacting their politicians and really put the screws to them, because this is just an outrage. Well, thank you again, Roger. I appreciate your coming on the show and talking to me about this.
Well, you're quite welcome.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed the show. Actually, I take that back. Enjoyed isn't the right word. I hope you were outraged by what you heard in this show. And if this got your blood boiling, then hold on to your hats for part two. When I talk more with Roger Pilon of the Cato Institute and Rob Johnson from the Institute for Justice about the most egregious and invasive area of civil asset forfeiture. Warning, folks, before you download that episode, you'd better put on some boxing gloves or oven mitts or something, because you're going to want to punch a hole in a wall when you hear about this. Kick-Ass Politics is sponsored by Gold Medal Wine Club. Since 1992, they've been America's leading independent wine club. And right now, if you go to the show site at kickasspolitics.com and click on our special link on the sponsor page, Gold Medal Wine Club will give you up to 45% off wines rated 90 points and up. Plus, they'll even throw in free shipping. For all your wine desires, Gold Medal Wine Club. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so you get fresh episodes as soon as they're available. And leave us a review on iTunes. That actually helps us a great deal. And if you like what we're doing here at Kick-Ass Politics, then please show your support for the show and make a donation by going to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/KickAssPolitics. Or go to the show website and click on the donate link. I appreciate your encouragement and support. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. Or leave a voicemail on the toll-free listener hotline at 844-KA-POLITICS. Again, you really don't want to miss the next podcast, where I'll talk about a relatively new exploitation of civil asset forfeiture that will absolutely make you see red. Be sure to download it. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.